I'm very happy now to welcome Randy Grissom. He's the director of the Sustainable Technology Center at the Santa Fe Community College in James Bingham, who is an instructor there. And they are going to be speaking tonight as part of the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers, doing a presentation called Burritos to Biofuels. And that is tonight at 6 o'clock. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Morning, Marjorie.
So, burritos to biofuels. Burritos, huh? I thought this was about algae.
Well, we thought we'd take a little leave of language and do a little something that would be catchy. Our program is based upon all sorts of biofuels and all different feedstocks. And so one of the feedstocks is taking waste grease from local restaurants and converting it into biofuels. In addition to that, we are looking at algae and other feedstock.
There are, I met somebody once who was in a, who basically had converted a van years and years ago to run on grease from kitchens, and they just basically went all through the United States and South America stopping at restaurants and getting their grease and becoming sort of a spectacle along the way. But that's become an accepted and fairly well-known biofuel.
Correct. In fact, we had a great experience a couple of weeks ago. James could share with couple from Canada that was doing the same thing.
Yeah, we had a couple from Canada that were doing an attempt at breaking the Guinness World Record of the longest miles traveled without stopping at a regular petroleum-based filling station. And they were up to like 25,000 miles, and they'd made it out here to the wild, wild west. And somehow got hold of Charles, who's my co-teacher, and myself, and they're looking for fuel. Well, we happen to have 40 gallons of biodiesel and 100 gallons of vegetable oil sitting in our lab getting processed. So we came by and we tanked them up and we gave them 1,200 miles worth of distance to go down the road. The next time we heard from them, they were in L.A. and had not had to stop for fuel until then.
Now, one of the fuels that we'll talk about in a moment is algae, which is a very interesting potential and real biofuel. But let's talk about what the range of biofuels is at this point in history and technology. I mean, everybody's heard of ethanol.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. I mean, it's interesting to know that the first Ford cars produced by Henry Ford ran on ethanol.
Is that right?
Right. So we didn't have the gasoline products and the petroleum products that we use today. Back in those days. So we're really going back to looking at fuels that we had before and we just quit using for lots of reasons.
Now, how is ethanol made?
Ethanol is just basically a distilled product. The ethanol that we put in our cars is no more fancy than the ethanol that used to use that moonshine. You know, corn squeezings, corn mash, anything that comes from a vegetable-based cellulosic material that we can ferment with yeasts and sugar. And the yeast eats the sugar that comes out of the mash, creates the alcohol, and that becomes distilled out as the ethanol.
So that's one biofuel. Mm-hmm. Is it always made from corn?
No, you can use a bunch of different varieties of things, whatever. And that's the cool thing about the research is they are beginning to develop more and more products that will break down the enzymes in other plant material that will allow us to get the starches and the sugars out of plant-based material. Corn is probably the most relevantly known and most frequently used just because of its notoriety in the days past from the moonshiners.
Right, right. And corn takes up, or whatever plant you're using, takes up quite a bit of land. And as people look to the future, they look to the increasing population on the planet, there is a question of whether, if we convert to biofuels, whether we are then taking away land that would otherwise be used for food.
Correct. I think one of the things we're very interested in the program at the community college is looking at other feedstock that's not going to come from food or replace food sources. So we're very interested in looking at things that can grow in arid soil, and things that can grow in wastewater, briny water, things that can grow in the desert where you can't really grow vegetables.
Have you looked at kudzu?
Well, kudzu hasn't been looked at that I know of, but buffalo gourd, which is a weed here in New Mexico, is highly a potential crop. Now, you know, growing a weed as a crop is different than letting it grow as a weed.
Right.
But the tuber is very rich in starches.
Very interesting. Tell us more about types of plants that could be used for biofuels that really would be farmed, so to speak, on land that couldn't be used for anything else.
Well, one of the big ones right now is camelina. A lot of research has been done in that area. Switchgrass is another potential one. Mm-hmm. And then, obviously, algae, which can be grown anywhere that you've got a water source, which doesn't have to be, you know, really good potable water necessarily.
Well, let's talk about that, because you have – I was reading one of your presentations about algae, and it does seem potentially a very rich source of biofuels using not a whole lot of space.
Correct. You can grow algae in open ponds. You can grow it in closed-loop bioreactors that can either be vertical or horizontal.
So like the equivalent of a silo full of algae?
Correct, except it's like a clear silo.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So there's a whole variety there. And basically what you're doing is short-circuiting millions of years of evolution that produced the oil in the earth anyway. You're growing it. The algae actually sequesters carbon. It uses carbon as a fertilizer. And so it has lots of variety of uses there.
Mm-hmm. And how do you measure the productivity and the comparative productivity of various types of biofuels?
The algae, we generally measure it out in gallons per acre, because we usually, it's considered, the majority of what we do is open ponds. So we've got a big flat piece of real estate that's got a pond in it, so we've got X number of square feet and X number of millions of algae molecules growing within the water that we harvest. So it's a matter of a ratio of a cell count, basic math, basic science, cell counts on a slide, and guesstimating the amounts of growth per slide, and then calculating that out, extrapolating that out to how many gallons per acre we think is there. The other neat thing is that we've discovered that there's hundreds of thousands of different strains of algae, and many of them are good for the pharmaceutical world, and then we're finding a whole bunch of them that are much more oil producing, and they're going to be very specifically used for our oil production. So we do have a differentiation in what are you going to actually grow your algae for.
So in theory, you can have an algae that eventually is jet fuel.
Exactly. Yeah, the folks down in Las Cruces, Sapphire, they are doing that exact same thing. They are creating what they call biojet. And they've run some experiments in their turbine engines with a highly processed algae oil as a fuel.
This seems like a great potential for reducing dependence on foreign oil, which is a cliche that everybody is always talking about. What kind of production would you have to start matching or, you know, making a real dent on reducing the oil supply that we're now either importing or drilling for?
Well, I think there's a lot of work going on in those areas. There's still a lot of R&D work going on to find the right strains of algae. My personal opinion is that it's part of the mix. I know in New Mexico we're taking a leadership role in exploring some of those things. If nothing else, one of the big opportunities is to replace jet fuel for the military. They consume a lot here in New Mexico, so that's a potential market. A lot of people could almost grow their own for their own transportation vehicles or their own heating capabilities, or even running generators.
When you think about algae, for example, or any biofuel, they sequester carbon, and then when they're burned, then they produce CO2 again. Is it a carbon neutral process ultimately?
It's carbon neutral because we're taking a plant, the algae, which has absorbed CO2 out of the air, and we're burning it in an engine as a fuel source, and that produces CO2 back into the air, but it's a closed loop. We're not taking in the sequestered CO2 that's been buried in the fossil fuels for millions of years and adding that additional CO2 back into the air. So the algae to CO2 in the atmosphere is a much more defined closed loop.
Is a closed loop, but presumably maybe the containers that you're making have to be shipped in from somewhere using... I mean, are there other parts of the production cycle that actually produce more
carbon producing?
Yeah.
Transportation costs. But the unique thing about the algae is that, especially out here in the wild, wild west, because the algae is a carbon sequestering plant, we're looking at putting big algae farms next to coal-fired power plants so that the distance the CO2 has to travel is minimal. We don't have to actually physically sequester the CO2 from the stacks at the factory and ship it to the algae farms. It just happens naturally through the airflow.
Very interesting.
So it eliminates that. And I think we will always have, to some degree, some kind of an impact. What we'll try to do is minimize it of some kind of CO2 output in transportation and manufacturing. We are continually striving to find the most economical and environmental ways to achieve fuel.
Can I add to that, too? One of the goals of the biofuels industry right now is to try to make use of the existing infrastructure if possible. So use the same pipelines that are currently being used to push oil around, use it to push biofuels around. Use the same trucking system, so not having to replicate anything at the present time. We think acceptance would come quicker that way, too.
Do they burn clean or the same amount of clean as petroleum fuels?
Biodiesel itself runs wonderfully cleaner than petroleum diesel in all aspects. Up until recently, they thought that the NOx emissions from biodiesel was higher, but they've gone back and they've done retesting with much more sensitive equipment, and they're discovering that the NOx emissions are no worse than petroleum diesel.
The what emissions?
NOx, the NOx, the stuff that makes the smog in the valleys, nitrous oxide. That's the particulate emission that makes smog. And that's the visible one that's the most infamous of the pollutants that are out there. And they're discovering now that as biodiesel refineries get more and more proficient at what they're making, a higher quality product, that their emissions, even in that area, are dropping off to standards that are either on par with petroleum or diesel or surpassing it. And everything else, all the other particulates in biodiesel, are way below what comes out of the tailpipe from petroleum diesel. The other really wonderful fact about biodiesel is that now that the EPA has mandated that we have this ultra-low sulfur diesel stuff, well, sulfur used to be the lubricant in petroleum diesel. Well, the trucking industry is just beside itself because all their engines are beginning to seize up because they've lost their lubrication. If we can go back and put as little as a 5% biodiesel solution into their petroleum, we've reintroduced the lubricity that the ultra-low sulfur stuff removed.
So very interesting.
Yeah, so there's many, many elements of biodiesel that are going to fit into the existing infrastructure and with the existing truck traffic that's out there.
We're talking to Randy Grissom and James Bingham from the Sustainable Technology Center at Santa Fe Community College. They will be talking tonight at 6 o'clock. We'll give more information about that at the end of the show today. Now, for example, using algae or growing any biofuel takes quite a lot of water. Are you working on systems that would take, for example, gray water or black water and use them in this whole cycle of energy production?
Yeah, one of the exciting things is algae doesn't really care about the type of water. So it can grow in wastewater. We think we could develop processing facilities adjacent to wastewater plants. We also know that it can grow in salty water, briny water. New Mexico has a lot of briny water under the surface. We're also very excited about the closed-loop systems, which minimizes the amount of water. In an open pit, you're obviously going to lose to evaporation. In a closed loop, you will lose some in the harvesting process, some water, but you're going to be able to conserve some too. So, one of the advantages New Mexico has is threefold. Number one, we have lots of sunlight. It takes photosynthesis to produce algae and for algae to grow. We've got lots of land. And we got lots of briny and wastewater and wastewater. We don't have lots of good potable water.
Right, but you wouldn't necessarily have to use any of that at all.
Correct.
So what kind of research and development are necessary for this to go into the kind of production and to be an actually used and effective source of fuel?
Well, James and I were just talking about that before. The biggest detriment right now is on the algae side is really still the extraction process. And James, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, we discovered the wonderful thing about algae is it has vegetable oil with inside the cell walls of each individual algae cell critter. But they've also discovered that even though the algae grows incredibly fast, you harvest it multiple times throughout a season, is that the cell wall where the oil actually resides is an incredibly tough membrane, and cracking that, getting it to open up, has been one of the stumbling blocks or the hindrances to getting production of volumes of oil into place. They've tried numerous things, the worst being hexane, which is a petroleum product, and it actually just basically destroys the cell wall and you can harvest the oil out of it. They've now moved on to the next one on the horizon that seems to hold the most glimmer of hope, is an ultrasonic system of radio waves thrown at the algae cell itself and causing the cell walls to open. I liken it best to the illustration of back in the day when Aretha Franklin used to do the Memorex commercials and would break the wine glass.
Right.
That's exactly what that ultrasonic system is doing. And what it does, because it's very low cost, because it takes very little amount of electricity to create the ultrasonic sounds, that harvests the oil. That seems to be our newest focus of how we're going to volume harvest oil.
It seems like also this is something where there's a great potential for decentralized production. Is that true?
Correct. I think a lot of opportunities are for distributed production. If in the algae area, you could have a variety of people growing algae and bringing it to a centralized local place for processing. Not everybody's going to have their own processing materials. So you could actually, it's almost like on-site generation or community-based generation of fuel.
Now, have the numbers been run, like how many years it would take to get enough fuel to power all the cars in Santa Fe or all the heating oil needs of Santa Fe?
What volume are we looking for? What kind of numbers of I guess, estimations of
right.
what kind of volumes we'd... That I don't know. I think we are at such a point of our focusing on research of, okay, we've got algae growing. We can grow algae in gobs. Now if we can, the next step is that we need to be able to harvest it in huge volumes, and then we'll start answering that next equation of how much fuel, how much algae, how much harvesting do we need to do to start replacing all of the petroleum demands in cities, counties, states, and nationwide.
Now, can you make other things the way you can from petroleum, from algae? In other words, plastics and things like that?
Yes, you can. There's, of course, the primary thing that we use, the harvested algae cell membranes and the plant particles left over are primarily animal feeds. A lot of it can go into health foods. Spirulina, I'm sure a lot of our listeners already take spirulina from as a health supplement. So there's those areas that we can reuse the second co-product of the harvesting after we've taken out our oil. The other one that I've learned about recently was soybeans. They harvest a lot of soybeans for their oil content further back east just because the conditions are better for that to grow out there. But there's a bunch of things that you can take the soybean mash and the soybean meal and the particulates and do the same thing, create plastics and other co-product goods like we do currently with petroleum products.
Now, one of the problems with the plastic made from petroleum products is that it lasts for hundreds of civilizations and it's having horrifying effects in the Pacific Ocean and so on. Would the plastics made from organic, from plants, be any more biodegradable than petroleum plastic?
Yes, yeah, considerably so, because the hydrocarbon chain from a plant is a little bit different structured, and it does break down much sooner. It's much more recyclable and much more biodegradable than the stuff that's going to last for, the next 20 lifetimes floating around out in the oceans. That's one of the nice things about it, is that we are used to plastic shopping bags and plastic coffee mugs and plastic dashboards on our car. But if we can, and we can replace those with the hydrocarbons from soybeans or algae, they are much more recyclable and much less toxic to create from the first place.
So if a car dashboard lasts 100 years instead of 100,000 years, it's still going to outlast your use of that car.
Yes, it will.
I think it is important to run the numbers. I mean, one of the things that I was really struck by was I saw a calculation of the world's energy needs 20 to 30 years from now, given estimates of population growth and estimates of development in developing countries. And basically, to provide the world's electricity, you would, for example, have to build a nuclear power plant every other day for the next 45 years, they last 40, 50 years, and then you've got a gazillion, innumerable pounds of radioactive waste that nobody still knows what to do with. I think it's very important to look at, when you say this is one of many sources, to really look at what those numbers are of how not only New Mexico, but how the country, how the world is going to meet its energy needs.
Correct. We're not going to get off of fossil fuels right away. We've got to come up with a game plan to mix things in, looking at renewable energies, whether it be solar, wind, biofuels. We've got to do a mixture of all those things, and hopefully with research and technology, we'll even be able to improve on what we can produce from renewable sources and actually lessen our dependence on the need for electricity through more efficient appliances and cars and whatever we're doing. So it's got to be a combination of all those things. But, boy, we need to get started now, and, you know, that's why we have these programs.
I have to say, I just had somebody from Energy Works, which is a program of the city of Santa Fe that's free, come over to the house, put weather stripping around all the doors, give me some compact fluorescent light bulbs, a couple of other things, wrap the water heater in insulation, wrap the pipes. That's something that the city of Santa Fe is doing for free, and they're tracking the energy reduction in that over the next 10 years. These are very interesting programs as well.
Oh, correct. And, you know, actually the biggest bang for our buck right now is energy efficiency and weatherization. We're losing a lot of energy through heat loss or air conditioning loss, through use of inefficient light bulbs. We can really reduce our need for coal-fired electricity or any type of electricity just by improving those things. So that really should be the first step.
I want to give the number, by the way, for that program, which here in Santa Fe is 505-470-5892. So Randy Grissom is director of the Sustainable Technology Center. James Bingham is an instructor there. It's at the Santa Fe Community College. And they will be speaking tonight in a program called Burritos to Biofuels, sponsored by the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers. That's part of the Santa Fe Alliance for Science. For more information, people can call 505-603-7468. And it's at 6 o'clock at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Education Annex at 123 Grant Avenue here in Santa Fe. And admission is free, and youth seating is a priority.
That's correct.
And it's just terrific that you guys are training our young people not only to think this way, but actually to do the work.
Mm-hmm. We're really excited about what we're doing at the college and about the programs, and we hope we see lots of young students tonight who get interested in science and technology.
Randy and James, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.